The Guardian.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen, sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. Our guest this month is Sebastian Faulks, whose novel Birdsong brought the First World War back into literature. Strange though it might seem for such an enduring bestseller, it was not a project that immediately grabbed Faulks' own publisher when he floated the idea 20 years ago. Who would want to read about the mechanised slaughter of the Great War? Faulks answered these doubts by both recreating the horrors and dramatising the curiosity of later generations about what really happened. Book Club Supremo John Mullen opened by asking Faulks what is revealed in his new introduction.
I think the purpose you're talking about is the theme, the ideas behind the book, what it's about. And at the time I wrote this, I was quite certain about what novels ought to be. And what they ought to be was about themes and big ideas. And the themes and the big ideas came first, and then you chose a framework or series of events which could exemplify these themes and ideas in action. And then you would choose characters who were capable of enacting the events that you had chosen. So it was all very orderly and so on. I think with Birdsong, it's true that I did have this kind of rather grand, almost military plan. And it had sprung, really, from all the books I'd read and the articles, the documents, the research I'd done onto the First World War, all of which had really brought up to me in me one question, which was, how far can you go? Were there no limits to what human beings would do? And if not, what does this tell us about the kind of creatures we are?
Indeed, in the introduction, you sort of describe spending, as it were, half the day writing and the rest of it in the Imperial War Museum.
Yeah.
I mean, presumably there is a peculiar pressure, given the topic, to kind of get every single thing right that could be got right.
There is, but the role of research in writing novels is, I think, quite misunderstood. When I would go into the Imperial War Museum in the afternoon and read very first-hand these documents, these diaries, letters, postcards and so on, which in many cases hadn't been read, I think, since they were deposited there in the 20s and 30s by the families of the men who'd fought. What they gave me was a feeling of authenticity, and they gave me a kind of confidence. I felt if I was handling all these things, these documents, I was almost one of the men themselves. And it wasn't that I sort of copied out a lot of stuff or checked cap badges or battalion numbers, none of which particularly interested me. It was just a way of sinking myself into the life of these people and feeling that I was one of them. No amount of research is going to substitute for what the novelist does, which is simply to take himself, herself, empty out all your characteristics and float above the person who is in the situation that you're writing about, and then very gradually, gently lower yourself down into their situation and feel what it's like. Imagine it, feel it, record it, remember it, and then pull yourself out again and come back to your typewriter, computer and tell it.
In a way, you make the business of finding out about what it might have been like. You build that into the structure of your novel.
It's partly that I was building my own process of curiosity, so partly they're a bit like the external plumbing on a Richard Rogers building, which I have left visible. But there was also a feeling I had at the time, which was no one was interested in this war. It had been confined to, oh, what a lovely war. It was badly remembered, partly the fact that there were so few accounts of ordinary soldiers from the First World War. There were only, you know, these great writers, Sassoon and Grays, but these were officer class memoirs with a huge irony and detachment, published mostly 10 years afterwards. There are lots and lots of reasons why that this war had become obscured, forgotten, and sort of placed in some sort of inverted commas. And in a way, Birdsong was an attempt to rip the inverted commas away and get back in the trench.
Because Elizabeth, the character, the granddaughter of the protagonist, Stephen, goes to the arch. I've never been there. Thiepval, is that how you pronounce it? Yeah. With the tens of thousands of names of Allied troops who just were lost, disappeared. Yeah, yeah. And she says, doesn't she, no, why didn't anybody tell me?
Nobody told. The modern sections were a courtesy to the reader, and they were there to answer that simple question, why should I care?
Yeah.
And they're there, and I quite like them. Yeah. But, you know,
And it was important also that the central character in those was female. I mean, that was a kind of...
very much so.
Yeah, why does that matter? Because otherwise it's all about men all the time.
Yes, it's all about men. And yeah. I suppose, you know, the person most likely to say, why would I care, would be a woman more than a man, I suppose. Because most men have experienced feelings of antagonism, fear, brutality, aggression and competition in a way that fewer women have. One has to be terribly careful about making sweeping generalisations, of course. But it's just slightly casting against the grain. It's just rubbing a piece slightly up the wrong way. It's all helpful in a way.
And the other thing about the structure of it is, of course, that the quite lengthy first part of the novel is set before the war in France and is this sort of whirlwind affair, in a way, and also highly illicit affair between Stephen and the wife of the man that he's staying with.
It sprang really out of a book I'd written before called A Fool's Alphabet, which is about places and the meaning of places. And it's always interested me, though it's one of those things that's interesting, though you can never really take it to any satisfactory conclusion, about why places whose names ring with a terrible sonorous bell, were they always destined to be like that? I mean, what was Hiroshima like when it was just an ordinary port? What was Auschwitz like when it was just a sort of barracks in the foothills? It was some sort of, before it even became a chemical factory, it was just a very ordinary place where people went about their business. And I'd often wondered what places were like before they became famous for being what they became. And the Somme was one place. This, you know, even the words, the Somme, they sound like a sort of bell, like a sort of funereal bell echoing. But actually, the Somme is a perfectly ordinary river in a rather dull part of France. And its tributary, the Ancre, on which the battle was fought, is actually quite pretty, perfectly pleasant land, sort of gentle rolling hills, growing beet crops and so on. So I very much wanted to show the Somme before it became the Somme. And the other reason I particularly wanted to have this love affair, which is a very physical love affair, is because of what we were talking about at the beginning, this idea of a theme, an idea that unites the book. And the question is, how far can you go? What can human beings do to one another physically, through flesh, through killing, through anger, through love, through sex, and so on? So, of course, there is more to the affair between Stephen and Isabel than simply the physical, but it is extremely physical, and the physicality of it was always... The idea of it was it would foreshadow the extremely sort of intimate nature of killing. And, you know, when someone's actually eviscerated or their legs are blown off, you know, this is, as well as being shocking and obviously unbelievably painful, it is a sort of weirdly intimate thing, I think, to see the inside of someone.
Yeah. I wanted to ask one more question about the sort of, not so much about the structure, about the narrative method of it, because you do something which... it's often said to be rather rare in literary fiction the last 10 or 20 years, which is that you have a kind of narrative omniscience. You move between the minds of different characters. Yep. And sometimes there are certain sections which seem to be given over to one person, but sometimes we're in a scene where you can move between people. You know, there's a great bit, for instance, one of my favourite bits is just after, which I feel is sort of Sebastian, knowing Sebastian a little bit, is a very sort of Sebastian sense of humour almost, which is after the lovemaking scene, between Stephen and Isabel. The next section starts with Isabel's husband, Azair.
Yes.
It says something like, Monsieur Azair was feeling very cheerful that evening. and the poor cuckold comes back from work. Again, was that something you were conscious of what needing to do to tell this story?
Yeah, it's a way of destabilising the reader to some extent. I don't change narrative point of view within any given scene, I think you'll find. I mean, that's one of those sort of self-imposed rules. I remember in an earlier book I wrote called The Girl at the Lion d'Or, which is also set in France, there was a scene when the two lovers break up in this sort of very sad way, and I had actually written it sort of with alternately giving their responses and feelings, but my then editor, a rather brilliant editor actually, called Richard Cohen, who was fired shortly afterwards, said, you know, you've got to stick with one character. And I said, but if we stick only with her, then with him, when we're dying to know what she thinks. And he said, well, that's fine. Then have the reader dying to know, and then in the next section, keep them waiting a bit longer, and then in the next section, you can tell them. And I use this as a sort of really self-imposed thing, and I've never really deviated from it. But there are also in Birdsong, I mean, there are some quite sort of serious jump cuts in sort of filmic terms. I mean, the most notable one being at the end of the first section concerned with the love affair. Then you go into France and you begin with a miner underground with several hundred thousands of tons of France pressing in his face. And this was supposed to make the reader think, whoa. And there are a lot of these cuts, and I was aware that all the time I was upping the ante and aware of that. But I wanted them to feel that this writer was capable of anything and that he wouldn't necessarily respect their expectations. So this is why, at one point, one of the nicest characters in the book has to die. It's a man called Michael Weir, who is Stephen's sort of mate, and they share a dugout together. And we're just, he was a very polite man, was trying to allow some people to go past him, and in allowing them to pass him, he steps onto the fire step, and as he steps onto the fire step, which is sort of raised up by this much, he's hit by a bullet from a German sniper. And I felt, as my son would say, I felt bad. I felt bad for him. But the reason that I wanted to do that was so the reader would say, but, you know, Michael Weir is one of the nicest characters in the book. This author is such a bastard. So that when Stephen is trapped with Jack underground at the end, the reader would think, normally, the hero's going to get out of this. But with this author, I don't know.
It's good you raised that, because I wanted to ask you about deaths.
It's pretty clinical.
Yes.
And it was meant to be so, and This is what happened. And they didn't die tragic or timely or well-ended deaths. They died by accident and in that brutally shocking, completely pointless way. And it seemed to me that was the best way to write about it.
Mm.
I mean, I talked to my father a bit, who fought in the Second World War and who was very reluctant to talk about it at all. My brother and I were always pestering him and... Eventually, when we were about 25, he finally said, all right, I'll tell you what happened. And we had an unbelievably interesting evening. A lot of it very comic, and a lot of it very mundane, and a lot of it very boring, but a lot of it, you know, much less so and very dramatic. And there was undoubtedly a way in which soldiers deal with these things, and that is you register what has happened. And I don't think you saw in a state of denial at the time. You do register, and you just deal with it later in your own way, and you deal with it by sort of binding tighter with those who haven't died, and by becoming, I think, more determined to make the pointless death of those whom you knew and were friends with, to make it seem not worthless. It may be pointless, but it mustn't be worthless. Mm. And I think that's the sort of immediate way in which they deal with it. But I think they also became better soldiers. Stephen, I was interested in his trajectory as a soldier, as a sort of almost professional soldier, really. And I don't think that he ever does become a good soldier. He's good at killing people.
Yes.
But I'm not sure that he's very good with his men,
He thinks he's not, doesn't he?
He's so-so.
Yeah.
But he is very, very surprised to find that his commanding officer, Grey, actually still cares who wins this war.
Yeah.
Stephen has long since become a sort of, as he describes it, I think, an exploration of how far men can be degraded. And he is both amazed, surprised, humoured a little bit, but also slightly impressed that still in 1917, his commanding officer is interested in what memorial they're going to put up and in winning.
Yeah.
I interviewed an old man, and I interviewed plenty of old men who'd been there. They were much less good than the documents, but it was nice to... It was actually just physically touching them that really made me... It gave me that sort of feeling of authenticity. It gave me a feeling of validation. You know, having met people and stood with them on the battlefields and so on and held their hand, shaken their hand, talked to them, it just made me feel less disconnected from it. But there was one guy I interviewed, a very old man in his 95, and I said, you know, it must have been terrible. And this was quite early in my research. He said, well, it was a bit rough. And I said, but the living conditions, you know, the trenches, the rats. He said, no, well, you know, we did a good deal of camping in my family, so I don't know. And I said, and what about the food? You know, the tea that tasted of petrol and, you know, the awful bully beef if you were lucky and then, you know, a slice of bread. And he said, well, I came from a very poor family and we didn't often eat twice a day. So I was happy to have rations twice a day. And I said, oh, God, okay. We went on like this. And then I said, well, what about going over the top? He said, oh, you didn't want to do that.
I think there are two bits of the novel people remember most. One is the sort of really quite short bit. I mean, I think it's only about 8 pages, describing the first day of the Somme and writing it years and years afterwards, and he wasn't there and he doesn't know what it was like. I find it very, just almost unreadably appalling. Just as he sees these people just being killed as they get out of the trenches, just piling up. And the other bit is the section underground. And there it is, I guess, is it not the sun? The fact that the sun has died means that the man really doesn't have any reason to get out.
Yeah, Jack has lost everything, really, so he's happy to die. Stephen, at that point, the person most important to him is Isabel, his lover, and Jack is very struck by this. He said, Stephen says, funny, Jack says, funny, it should be you I'm with at this moment in my life when I die. Stephen, who had previously tried to court-martial him and behaved rather badly towards him. And they have a discussion about who would you expect, who would you like to share your last moments with. And Stephen says, Isabel. And Jack is absolutely amazed. He said, what, not your own flesh and blood? And Stephen says, well, I think in some ways she was my own flesh and blood. And indeed, the book was originally titled Flesh and Blood. It was a sort of working title for it, which seemed in the end a bit too sort of obvious and corny. When I wrote this book, which, as we've agreed, is 20 years ago, narrative was something not much present in literary fiction, and I was interested in see what narrative could do, and I'm interested in Zola's books quite a lot, which opinion is rather divided on, but there's a scene in Germinal in a mine.
Yeah.
I remember reading that scene thinking, God, you know, Is literature allowed to be so exciting? There are one or two people that I make sort of oblique reference to. Obviously, the fact that Stephen is rescued by a German. Anyone who's done GCSE will hear Wilfred Owen there. And in the early part of the book, the love affair in French, you know, French provinces. I mean, well, you can, the whole number of French novelists who may well be in the back of your mind when you read that, though a lot of people talked about Flaubert. But really the novelist I was thinking of was Stendhal, in fact, and there's a tremendously good love affair at the beginning of Le Rouge et Le Noir, which I also had in mind. And the way he builds tension, erotic tension is through just very, very one step at a time. And he touches her hand, then he touches her knee, and you think, my God, this is an early 19th century novel, surely not. And then, if you haven't read it, I do recommend it. It's very, very, very powerful. And
Well, it's probably time that I should hand over to our cognoscenti.
Given that this is a novel where the characters are in situations which are horrifying, terrifying, traumatising, what was the emotional experience for you of writing the novel?
It was very positive, oddly enough. I wrote it 20 years ago, 1992. We had a two-year-old, one-and-a-half-year-old child, and my wife was expecting another one. Time of great domestic happiness. The little boy was unbelievably charming and so on. And I felt very, very focused on this. I was aware that this book was something... I didn't know if it would be any good, but I was aware it was something I passionately wanted to do and that I would only have one chance at doing. And I was intellectually completely focused on it. And the fact that there are so many very highly emotional scenes in it actually worked for me in a rather sort of in a selfishly cathartic way, because I did quite a lot of sobbing from time to time. It really cleared out my tubes, as it were. And, you know, when you cry, you're not necessarily crying about the thing which has prompted it. You're just getting a lot of other stuff off your chest at the same time. And I decided that the thing to do was, if I did feel moved or overcome by what I was describing, not, I hasten to say, by the brilliance of my writing, but by the thought of what real people had really undergone, that I would wait until that sadness and that sense of passionate indignation and anger, because there's a lot of anger as well, wait until that had passed before resuming writing the book. But I can honestly say that I don't think I've ever felt happier. I wanted to end with this birth because it's the redemption of Jack. It's the validation of a promise made by Stephen to Jack, and it ends the book on an upbeat, because the fact is that even if you kill 10 million people for no reason, babies will go on being born and the world will continue. What we have to do is adjust our view of it, but it will continue.
Good evening. Earlier you spoke about the use of jump cuts, and I wondered to what extent you were conscious of using techniques that are, I suppose, drawn from a grammar of film in writing the novel.
I mean, I think what films are really good at is narrative. I think that I love the way films move around and tell stories and jump and go long and go very tight and then pull back. And I was aware of, I used this technique a lot, particularly in this book, of being very, very unbearably extreme close-up in some scenes, and then really on a very long lens and a very wide shot on in other scenes. And I think that's what films are really good at. What they're less good at is character, because they haven't the resources, the material to go inside people. But I also, from music, borrow a lot of ideas of construction of themes, setting them out, varying them, coming back to them and bringing them back and so on. And then there's a really quite an orchestral finish, which relates back to the last question of, I suppose it does end on a... It's not the instrument you would expect to play the final few notes. But yes, I was quite aware of that, particularly in this book, of those sort of filmic things. And I think everyone... And I sometimes think in terms of painting as well, of slabbing it on, you know, you want to establish things. And I use a lot of paint in the domestic scenes early in the book. It's very thickly painted. And that's partly, I think, it goes back to when I first started writing, of a feeling that all novelists, I think, have of... Why is anyone going to believe this rubbish? The man came into the room and sat down. Good morning. He said, well, he didn't. What man? What room? None of this exists. And quite early on, I found a way of overcoming my own lack of self-confidence was to make the room so bloody credible that you really had to believe it.
At the beginning, you mentioned about Raisford's idea of seeing how far people could lower themselves, so to speak. Is it... simplistic to think that you came to a conclusion that there's at least, I won't call it optimism, but hope, because you do finish with new life?
Mm-hmm. The title of the book, which also caused some discussion, is a rather shy, ironic title. And the function of birds singing and animal life continuing, it isn't meant to represent some hope of, you know, life springs eternal and it'll all come out all right in the morning. What it's supposed to represent is the utter indifference of the natural world to the idiocy of humans. So the tweeting is not, oh, it's fine, it's, for God's sake, you know. I mean, humans are just one species, and in this four-year period, the lowest of the species on the planet by a distance.
I read your book first time in 1994, and it made sense of conversations I'd had with my grandfather 20-odd years earlier. I hadn't quite worked out why he hadn't been able to talk about the war. He was at Passchendaele, and he got mustard gassed out of the war. And it, apart from physically ending his life effectively, because he was in agony for the last 30, 40 years of his life, he would never talk. We had lots of conversations about his youth and childhood and his life, but he refused point blank to talk about the war. And it was only when I read your book that I think I actually began to understand why he didn't. And my question really is about survival, because after the war, Stephen survived the war, but in another sense, he didn't survive it. And I wonder if you were trying to make the point in your novel that even those people who came home and lived didn't really survive, because he couldn't talk about it. Well, he couldn't talk, could he, for 2 years? Mm-hmm. He couldn't talk about the war, certainly. And there must have been thousands and thousands of men who came back from those trenches who couldn't bring themselves to share their experiences with people.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. It's not a universal thing. It varied from person to person. And there were people, not everyone went over the top. Not everyone was involved in a major battle like that. Not everyone was gassed or wounded. Indeed, there were people who, I wouldn't say enjoyed it, but they found it invigorating to be with men of their own age. They came from families where they didn't have much opportunity of employment, perhaps. And they actually, you know, it was a quite positive experience for some men. But undoubtedly, the great pall of silence that hung over a large number of them concealed trauma of various kinds. My own grandfather, whom I never met, because he got a bullet through the head in the Second World War, but he'd been in the First World War, where he was gassed but survived. And I don't think he ever spoke to my mother about it at all. Perhaps there wasn't a great deal to say. It's just something. I think that burying things and not confronting them, while it may not be psychologically very healthy for everyone, it works for some people.
I just want to ask a more general question about how has it been received in other countries? I mean, it must have been widely published around the world and presumably translated. I was wondering how it had been received in perhaps America.
In America, it was pretty well received. Actually, that's not quite true. It took a long time to find a publisher in in America. No one was interested in the First World War. And my previous publisher, I was in New York, and I went to see this woman, and she'd read Birdsong and had been told that we were pretty excited about it. And she sat me down and said, your book is far too long. And furthermore, had you considered relocating it in a more recent conflict? So I did recast it as a novella set in Vietnam. No, I didn't. But it was really hard to get it published in America because it was long and British and European and full of old war stuff. But eventually we did get it published, and it was published by Random House, and very well, and with a lot of conviction. And I flew backwards and forwards across America about 3 times flogging it, and it did pretty well. And in Germany did pretty well as well, France not. The French were surprised to discover that any other nationality had been involved.
It's such a huge book, and it's such an amazing. Did you know when you wrote it that you'd really hit a sweet spot? I mean, we all do projects and work in life, and sometimes you know you're on something very special. Did you feel that at the time? And then afterwards, was there an exhaustion about people's expectations you just to roll these books out? How did that feel? And here you are 20 years on, talking about that book. Does it become a burden in some ways?
It's not a burden. I wrote the book in 6 months, and I pulled out this morning. I dated it for some reason as I was going along, which I suppose shows I felt at the time that it might be something that I'd come back to. And this is what I wrote 20 years ago. This is the first sentence I wrote 20 years ago today. Azair was at first proud to have married such a young and attractive woman and liked to display her to his friends. He saw his children prosper under her attention. And I wrote 5 pages that day. That's quite a good...
Those were your first 5 pages?
No. We're page 49. The Sunday morning, Stephen rose early and went downstairs to find something to eat in the kitchen. And then we find ourselves going off to the water gardens. Madame, good morning, what a lovely day. Bérard was at his most expansive. He held out his arm to help Madame Azair down into the boat. And so on. Stephen settled opposite Madame Azair as instructed and found room for his feet on the floor of the boat while trying not to touch hers. Bérard let out a nautical cry and clambered into the stern, where he pushed the bark off from the bank with a long wooden pole. And it was a little joke to myself, the wooden pole, because when I actually went on those water gardens myself, the guy who was steering the boat was himself a pole, with a capital P. sometimes you feel you're doing something exceptional and you feel that you're in the zone and you've got something and you're locked onto it. And the big feeling in your mind is, don't let's mess this up. Don't let's mess this up, because this isn't going to come again. And I was never going to write 2 books about the First World War. Certainly not so head-on. It's a very simple book, Birdsong. You know, it's really head-on. It's, if in doubt, go louder, go faster. That was the sort of tactic in the book. And I was desperately aware of not wanting to mess it up. But I went, as I wrote it in 6 months, I wrote it fast, and every time I felt I was going to fall, I put my foot into a void, but there was something there. I didn't quite know what was going to happen from one day to another. But when I got to the end, I did feel exhausted, happy, shattered, purged, and I didn't have the feeling that I'd messed it up. But I didn't for a minute expect that anyone else would think so too. Anyone else would like it, read it, bother with it. You know, you cannot have expectations as a writer. So many thousands of books are published. Or many authors think they've written something tremendous and the world does not agree. Because it was my fourth book, I was aware by then that that was the fact. It's been a wonderful thing. And if you could plan your life and your career as a writer, which of course you can't, to have, you know, health and time and thought and scope to write maybe 20 books, which I hope I will, if there's one which is the sort of locomotive, I don't think that's a bad thing. And if this is, you know, the book that people remember when I die, then fine by me.
And thank you all so much for coming, and thanks to Sebastian for... Thank you.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen is sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar. Cornish cheddars made with over 60 years of knowledge, time and skill. To find out more, please visit davidstowecheddar.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.